Good afternoon, and calling State Affairs Committee to order at 3:07 p.m. Thursday, April 20th, 2017, in the Max Grunberg Room in the Alaska Capitol. Will the Secretary please call the roll?
Representative Tuck.
Here.
Representative Josephson.
Here.
Representative Knopf. Present. Representative Wohl. Not here. Representative Ledoux. Not here. Representative Birch.
Here.
Representative Johnson. Not present. Chair Chris Humphrey.
Here. And with the bare four members present, we have a quorum to conduct business. Worth noting that Representative Johnson, Representative Ledoux, Representative Wohl, Representative Knopf are all excused. Present as well as Representative Copper, other alternate, is also out of town and can't join us. So, but we do have four members here, and we can get some stuff done. Also, welcome Heather to the State Affairs Committee. It's great to have you. And thanks to Martha for keeping us going all these first 90 days of session. We have two items on today's agenda, House Bill 235, the North Star Medal. This is the second hearing, and as noted on Tuesday, it's the intent to move this bill from committee. We also have public testimony notice for HB 235 and one amendment submitted, which should be distributed to members. And then for House Bill 11, this is the first hearing, legislation from Representative Kawasaki, and this is the RIP bill. And it's also worth noting that we did at one point have the Lao Hmong driver's license veterans status piece of legislation notice for today, but at the request of the sponsor and also Vice Chair Ledoux, we're going to hold that till Tuesday and hold public testimony that time. So the first bill, House Bill 235, this is the second hearing, and I'd like to start with public testimony, which was noticed for today, and there are two people online, and we'll also take any testimony in the room. I see first in the queue, Jake Metcalf in Anchorage. Mr. Metcalf, if you could put yourself on the record, state any affiliation, and present your testimony, we would be grateful.
Thank you, members of the legislature. My name is Jake Metcalf. I am the executive director for the Public Safety Employees Association, Local 803. We are headquartered in Anchorage. We represent 800 state municipal police department employees working throughout Alaska. Our membership includes the Alaska State Troopers, the Anchorage and Fairbanks Airport police officers and firefighters, Alaska court system officers, Alaska deputy fire marshals, and Ketchikan, Sitka, Juneau, Fairbanks, Soldotna, Dillingham, and Unalaska Police Department employees. Many of our members are also trained as search and rescue professionals. I think most of you know that in the last 4 years, PSEA tragically lost four of our members in acts of valor and heroism. They include Trooper Tage Toll, who died in a helicopter accident rescuing a stranded snow machiner. In May of 2014, longtime Alaska State Trooper Scott Johnson and Trooper Gabe Rich were murdered protecting the people of Tamanaw, Alaska. And in October of 2016, less than a year ago, Fairbanks Police Department Sergeant Alan Brandt lost his life responding to a call to protect the people of Fairbanks. He was shot multiple times and died as a result of those injuries. And prior to 2013, we've lost other members in similar situations, and the tragedies that I just discussed were just the most recent losses. And over time, Alaska has lost many police and fire first responder heroes. So I'm speaking today in support of this bill. The North Star Medal would recognize the bravery and valor of our lost heroes, and Troopers Toll, Johnson, Rich, and Officer Brandt, who I mentioned earlier, share one important fact in common. They all ran toward danger to help and protect Alaskans. Other Alaskan peace officers, firefighters, EMTs, search and rescue professionals do this same duty and responsibility every day. Their acts of bravery and valor in the service of their fellow citizens deserve recognition and honor, and I believe that this legislation is a lasting way for Alaska to show that honor to the surviving spouse, the survivors and the co-workers and the citizens of Alaska. So I hope that you will pass this bill. I want to thank Representative Christ Tompkins for introducing it. We hope that the legislature passes this bill quickly, and I'm available for any questions if there are any.
Thank you very much, Mr. Metcalf, for your testimony. Any questions from the committee? Thank you again, Mr. Metcalf.
And thank you for the opportunity to testify, and have a good day and weekend.
Thank you. I think we all will. And next in the queue, the other person online for testimony is Brandy Johnson in Fairbanks. Ms. Johnson, if you can put yourself on the record, state your affiliation, and present your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brandy Johnson. I am testifying in support of House Bill 235 on behalf of surviving families of line-of-duty death law enforcement officers in the state of Alaska. As many of you are well aware, my husband Scott was murdered while in the performance of his job as a sergeant with the Alaska State Troopers on May 1st, 2014. After Scott was murdered, I received many great gifts. Some of these gifts were quite thoughtful, some were very honorable, and some were even quite strange. I was perplexed. During the grieving, I initially thought, how is this gift or item supposed to make me feel better? My mother reminded me to just say thank you. What I later came to realize is that most of the gifts brought comfort to the givers and some brought comfort to my family. Once I came to this realization, I was more accepting and comfortable and happy to know that I was helping them with their grief. On the mantle to the fireplace Scott and I built sits the urn of my best friend and the father to our children. Atop this urn stands the triangular shape of the Alaska state flag. These are some of the most cherished items nobody wants to have. However, there are a few gifts that are special and meaningful, if not to me, but to our daughters. They may not provide comfort initially, but after the strong initial grief subsides, one realizes the thoughtfulness that went into the gifts and honors. The most important act we can do is to take care of that officer's surviving family. That is our fiduciary duty after the ultimate sacrifice. If providing the surviving family and or officer with a medal to recognize their oath and extraordinary efforts on behalf of the state of Alaska brings one minuscule of comfort, then I support the idea. With that being said, I'd like to recommend a process to the committee and or the commissioner of the Department of Public Safety on proper presentation to the next of kin for the North Star Medal if this bill were to pass. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson. Any questions or comments from the committee? Seeing none, move to any testimony in the room. Is there anyone here in Juneau who would like to testify on House Bill 235? Seeing none, I will close public testimony on HB 235, and that brings us back to the bill before the committee. There is one amendment that was submitted before the deadline yesterday at 5 p.m., an amendment from our office. Mr. Lardy, if you could speak briefly to the amendment, which I think is largely technical in nature.
My name is Stephanie Gilardi. I'm staff to Rep. Christ Tompkins, and the amendment D.1 is a technical amendment. We intend to include correctional officers in the group of individuals eligible for the North Star Medal, and because correctional officers are included only in the Title 39 definition of peace officers and not in the Title 1 definition for peace officers, we wanted to clear up any confusion by making their inclusion explicit by listing out correctional officers in the bill. Legislative Legal advised us to make this change.
Any questions for Ms. Gilardi relating to Amendment D.1? Seeing none, thank you very much. Is there a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I move that we adopt Amendment D.1 that the members have and insert correctional officer at line 2, or line 5, rather.
Is there any objection to the motion to adopt Amendment Number 1, Work Order D.1? Seeing none, Amendment Number 1, D.1, is adopted, and that is the sum of our amendments, which takes us to the bill and committee discussion and action. Are there any comments or discussion on House Bill 235? Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I was looking at making sure that the organized militia of the state of Alaska had some sort of recognition, because the only one I could find is the one that if they were deceased, actually there's two of them, one for the public and one for military business affairs, but that's after they were to die in action. But fortunately, checking with Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, they have like 15 different ways of honoring others in other situations, that being one of them. So I feel comfortable that they're taken care of. Because after all, this bill was a Purple Heart, if you will, for state rescuers and first responders. So that was cleared up. And just real quick, is there, when we talk about first responders, is there any limitation on that, or is it anyone who responds to a scene for the assistance of helping people out?
I might defer to Ms. Schiller. Do you have any perspective on that question?
Representative Tuck, through the chair, I will have to get back to you about a technical definition if there is one. For first responders, my understanding is that includes law enforcement and search and rescue and EMTs and that group of people, but I don't know if it also applies to any individual who responds.
If I may, Mr. Chair, the reason why I brought that up is because we had a presentation in the Arctic Policy Committee today regarding maritime identification vehicle. I forgot what the acronym is, but how with the new system they have right now, how oftentimes a boat in the area will come to the rescue of another boat, even though they're not the Coast Guard or they're not a trooper. And I just didn't know if we wanted to put limitations on that, or if that would be considered a first responder, someone coming to rescue another ship that might be sinking.
And I think I could speak to that a little bit, sort of the Good Samaritan scenario, particularly on the ocean, which, of course, is not uncommon. I guess sort of twofold thoughts. It sounds as though the first responder definition at least has some sort of wiggle room and sort of room for discretion for the Department of Public Safety or ultimately the Commission of Public Safety to sort of include as needed. But also, as I believe came up in the first hearing, the state medal for heroism, which has at least traditionally been awarded to people, sort of regular Alaskans or people sort of going through the course of their daily life who encounter a scenario where someone is sort of stricken or vulnerable and they sort of insert themselves into the scene, might sort of be appropriate for that scenario, sort of given the situations in which that medal has been awarded in the past. But I think there might be wiggle room to sort of speak to what you're describing.
Okay, and then, Mr. Chair, I have another scenario.
Yes, Representative.
And that's where a car hits a power line. Power line comes down. First responders can't get that person out until the power linemen show up, and the power linemen are the ones that are able to safely remove the energized line to get someone out. Because I just recently watched a video where that has happened, and so mm-hmm. I hope that also falls underneath the first responder. They're actually paid employees. They actually are there to fix emergency situation. And I hope this also includes them in that definition.
Noted. That's
where they have to go into a place of danger to rescue someone else. Not as Good Samaritans. They're actually paid to do that.
Yeah. So. Thank you. Representative Tuck, any other committee Comments? Representative Birch?
Somehow the electrician always ends up the hero. I never know how. Right. I don't know. I think of mining accidents where the mining guy shows up and drags people out that are unconscious. I support the bill. I think it's a great effort. I think the discretion there is left to the governor and the Department of Public Safety to decide whether or not it's a lineman or a mining guy or anybody else. My inclination would be that it would be more directed and focused on the traditional fire, life safety, EMT, those sort of people. But I think the flexibility does exist in the way this is written, that the governor and the commissioner of public safety can make that, have the discretion there. But speak in support of the bill. I think it's a great effort and certainly appropriate recognition. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Birch. Any further committee comments? Is there a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move House Bill 235 as amended. It's version 30-LS0816-D as amended today with attached zero fiscal note and individual recommendations.
Seeing and hearing no objection, House Bill 235 moves from committee as amended with attached zero fiscal note and individual recommendations, and the paperwork will circulate as we truck on to House Bill 11. This is the first hearing for House Bill 11. Representative Kawasaki, sponsor, if you'd be available to come up and present the bill along with staff, Mercedes, and present the bill.
Good good afternoon, Chair Christ Tompkins and members of the committee. I just wanted to, first of all, thank you for hearing the bill, and secondly, thank you for putting Real ID in the lap of the Finance Committee. We're listening to it right now, and I'm going to join them as soon as I'm done with the presentation. House Bill 11 is an act to incorporate an early retirement incentive program for people who are in the defined benefit system or in the teacher retirement system, or PERS or TERS system. It's a temporary voluntary retirement incentive program. I believe in a time when we're looking at protecting our natural resources and specifically in our budget, that we have to find ways that we believe that will help our budget. An early retirement system is really a simple concept. It's used in both private sector and public sector around the world. My aunt and uncle took advantage of an early retirement program from a private company when they had a downturn during the pharmaceutical days in the late 90s. They were able to take advantage of that particular early retirement program, and they're enjoying life now. So a retirement incentive program really isn't that novel, although it is being currently looked at in 22 other states right now that are also trying to meet their budgetary situations. What an early retirement incentive typically does is it says, as an employee gets more and more years under their belt, they typically also earn a little bit more during those times. Certainly, if you're a state employee, there's wage increases, there's step increases, and there's merit increases that are available to state employees and teachers. So those folks who are nearing retirement or past the retirement age typically are considered expensive employees. When we look at the budget, we see a PCN, we see a person that makes a certain dollar amount. We understand that's a larger dollar amount than, say, a person on the lower end. What the simple concept is that if we can encourage somehow that person at the top end of the wage scale to retire early, that somebody in a younger pay scale range can maybe assume their position, but it'll be at a much lower cost. So that's really the simple down and dirty of it. In 1986, there was an estimated savings of approximately $25 million for a retirement incentive program that was looked at then. A legislative audit of 1989's retirement incentive program demonstrated a savings of over $23 million with nearly 1,764 individual participants. In 1996, Representative McGuire also introduced a retirement incentive program. The fiscal note, I think, is in your packet. It could have saved the state over $41 million in initial savings. I just wanted to also say that The court system, which is not subject to the Executive Branch Ethics Act or the legislative body, can do their own. They, in fact, did have something of an early retirement incentive program in place. There were roughly 26 or 27 employees who were able to use this incentive. 14 of them did. That net savings for FY18 will be approximately $680,000, and I think Nancy Mead will be here to testify on that behalf. So I guess without any others, if there's any quick questions, I'd be happy to take them, and then back to Real ID.
Yeah, absolutely. And we do have invited testimony. Maybe take a few questions and then go to invited testimony and free you up to head to the fifth floor, Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, just some quick, I think, softball-type questions. You mentioned the court system. Does the court system have the authority voluntarily to do this administratively? Is that your understanding?
So, again, I think Nancy Mead will be speaking to that, but yes, the court system, through the chair, the court system is allowed to do that because they're an autonomous agency. The university would, since it's under the Executive Branch Ethics Act, would still need to have some sort of enabling legislation. That's why they would be included in this bill as well.
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, are persons interested, are they counseled? I assume they're counseled about I assume they would obviously receive less of a defined benefit through the span of their life than otherwise. And I assume they're counseled about that fact and left to sort of weigh the pros and cons of that.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Josephson, I think the people that are nearing retirement age know exactly what they're doing when it comes to their retirement. We do have retirement and benefits managers and staff that are able to help people that are nearing the age trying to decide whether they retire or not. There's some people that know exactly what they want to do. They want to buy a yacht. They want to cruise around the coastline here in Southeast. I don't think it's a problem that people would take this voluntary program not understanding the full effect of what would happen with their retirement.
And just, I guess, yeah, thank you. My last question, follow-up, is just, and I guess there's no way to quantify this, is the loss to the state in terms of talent. There's so many talented people that we see in this building, and I don't know how we would measure what it means to give up 3 more years of that talent. And what we might gain from someone else moving up the totem pole.
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I think that's valid. You know, there are a bunch of senior level folks, people who are, I mean, really an institution unto themselves. We hate to see these folks go. And, you know, the reason why the Department of Personnel and the commissioners at the commissioner level will be able to make those decisions is because we don't want the entire oil and gas tax division to suddenly say, well, we're going to all retire en masse. So there are some structures in place to prevent sort of the en masse retirement from occurring. At the same time, there are a lot of folks that are, you know, they're ready to retire, I think. They'd be encouraged to retire. And there's folks that are young, motivated, ambitious to go out there and become the managers and the supervisors that are really, you know, just waiting and chomping at the bit to do that. So I think it has pros and cons that'll be weighed out. I would also say through the chair that, you know, this is a really complex issue. There's, like I said, 22 states in the last couple of years that have looked at retirement incentive and early retirement incentive programs and how they work. And you can say, a person has to be 60 years of age, they have to be within 2 years of retirement or 3 years of retirement. You can say they have to pay a certain amount of health care percentage-wise, or maybe the bonus is just a flat number. And so it is such a complex issue that, if the chair would like to see it in a subcommittee of some sort so that you can review the real intricacies of how an early retirement plan would work, I know that it would be great interest amongst a lot of folks in the building.
Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Kawasaki. Sounds like good interim work. Representative Birch.
Through the chair, thank you. Looking at your sponsor statement, legislative audit of 89 retirement demonstrated savings of $22,1764 participants. It works out to about $13,000 plus or minus per person. or individual. Is that a net? Is that the net value of that? Or when you say $22 million in savings, is that per year, or is that a just a one time net present value of the of that change in cost over time?
Thank you. Through the chair, you want to answer it? Okay.
Hi, for the record, Mercedes Colbert, staff to represent Kawasaki. Through the chair, Representative Birch, in the sponsor statement, the amounts totaled there are net savings, not adjusted for inflation there at the time, and that's after accounting for all the administrative costs.
So that's a one-time net present value, a discounted rate basically over time by coming in with a...
Through the chair, that's my understanding that it's throughout the course of the RIP program being in place.
Okay. Follow-up?
Follow-up.
Just had a question regarding the potential or the merits of vacating a position once that position retires, and either transitioning to a contract position or otherwise. And as an example, I know Alyeska Pipeline is an example. You know, you got a declining throughput. One time they had 2,200 employees and 800 contractors, and that's about flipped now. It's about 800 direct employees and 2,200 contractors. Contractors providing a significant amount of additional latitude in, whether they are necessary on a year-round basis or not. Are you aware of any programs such as this where there's an inducement to not backfill a position if it's not necessary, and how do you weigh that into this consideration?
Through the chair, Representative Birch, if I may, I feel like several of the questions that have been presented from members are intersectional. And I'd be happy to walk through that if the chair would allow. But there are provisions in the bill that addresses reemployment, and there are limitations on that. Because if I understand your question correctly, you're asking essentially what's the risk of them being rehired on contract to backfill the position with somebody new. I just want to make sure I understand that correctly.
For instance, an Anchorage school district, they could probably save $10 to $15 million a year by contracting custodial, building maintenance, food service, security, on and on. But it's always challenging when you have people that are occupying those positions right now. But if a position were to retire or be incented to retire, and you backfilled that position with a position that nominally was 70% of that cost, because you have a competitive market you're dealing with, I'm just wondering if there's any sort of recognition for that or inducement to make that happen. Because we do hear, like from the Anchorage School District, for example, that they're challenged financially and just trying to look at alternatives. And this might be an inducement where you can encourage people to retire and then backfill them with a less costly alternative means of getting the same work done.
Through the chair, actually, now that I understand your question a little better, it's not quite that specific, but I'm sure we'd be interested in entertaining being more specific. I think that's not quite as specific in the bill, but there's some similar provisions.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Birch. And this time we can also go to invited testimony. We have two people online. I should also mention that Kathy Lee is in the room, Chief Pension Officer with the Division of Retirement and Benefits, as well as Nancy Mead, the Alaska Court System, available for questions. Online, we have Kelly McGee with the University of Alaska in Fairbanks, as well as Erica Van Fleen. Ms. McGee, we have you down for invited testimony. If you could put yourself on the record, state your affiliation, and present your testimony.
Hi, this is Kelly McGee. I'm Chief Human Resource Officer at the University of Alaska. And just wanted to thank Representative Kawasaki for bringing this forward. There are lots of things that Erica Van Fleen, who's the Director of Benefits, will speak to that might need to be addressed before this would be a viable possibility. But one of the things that we find is that as we are cutting costs, there are employees, long-time loyal employees, that are really wanting to retire and come to us on a regular basis and say, is there any way that I can retire a couple years early? I'm ready to go, and it will pave the way for someone less costly to take over my responsibilities. And we are unable to do that without legislation. So So that is an important point that I think that as we're in these very financial difficult times, it gives some flexibility to do the job, but also allow people to go to the next phase in their life that they would like to go. We're cautious about just encouraging people to do that. It's more of people we know and identify and come to Human Resources asking if there's a way that they can, which they can't currently. So thank you, and I will pass that to Erica Van Flyn, who has more details to point to. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. McGee and Ms. Van Flyn. I apologize for mispronouncing your name the first go-around. Likewise, before your testimony, if you could put yourself on the record and note your affiliation.
Yes, thank you. This is Erica Van Flyn. I'm the Director of Benefits here at the University of Alaska. And we have gone through the bill as presented and noted there are a few things that, while I agree with Kelly on the need for some sort of a tool that we can use to help employees who are ready to leave but not quite ready under the retirement plan to leave, whether just because they want to move on to something else or because their position is being either restructured or eliminated, it is nice to have this in the toolbox. There are some concerns that we have with the bill, though, that we would need to have corrected. Besides a couple of technical corrections, there is one amendment that adds the university to the intent and purpose of the bill, but as it's currently written, we are not included there. In the section on Section 7, we would need to fix this to address the fact that our optional retirement program is not a defined benefit plan. It is a defined contribution plan. Because we have so many employees in our defined contribution optional retirement plan, that could also limit some of the effectiveness of this bill for us. We would need to also clarify the ability to refill positions because the bill starts out with intent language that these positions affected by the RIF would be eliminated or not filled. But some of these positions would be probably critical to the university, and we would need to be able to refill them. And I would like some clarification on what our options are for refilling these positions. The bill also requires that the administrator of the program is the only person who can approve or deny the applications. But we have experienced with past retirement incentive programs, the most recent one that I believe the last year was 1999 that somebody could retire. We experienced a severe loss of key talent in our faculty ranks from the program, and it left us in rebuild mode for a number of years. It also led to the rehiring on a temporary or adjunct basis a lot of these faculty to keep the programs in effect and moving forward. So some sort of administrative authority to approve or deny applications at our level, at the university level, would be something we would want to see in the bill. The ability to rehire positions, especially in our faculty ranks, raises some issues, especially if our pay is determined to be under market for some positions. If you are able to keep an employee in a position, not that we try to keep people in an underpaid status, but a salary survey might show that we are under market in some areas. If these positions are the ones that are vacated by the optional or the RIF, and it's determined that we do need to refill these positions, we could be looking at refilling them and then actually at a higher rate. And the last thing that I just wanted to point out right now is the effect that reducing our PERS population would have on the PERS 2008 salary floor requirement. This is Alaska Statute 39.35.255, requiring us to pay the PERS employer contribution of 22% on the salary base in effect at the end of fiscal year 08. Currently, we are $18.9 million under that level, requiring an additional payment of $4.1 million for the FY16 plan year. while these positions are possibly, the WIP would be an alternative to layoff in some of these situations if some of these units or departments had to be restructured or eliminated, we understand that our PERS base could go down anyway because of this. But by the nature of the retirement incentive program, to have higher paid employees leave and bring in to refill the positions at a lower pay, you are feeding right into this shortfall from FY08. So those are my main concerns that we have on our reading of this HB 11. We, as Kelly said, appreciate the intent and the effort to provide another tool that we can use in these very tough times. And the bill has a lot of merit and a lot of possibility. We just do have some things that we would need for it to be a really effective tool for us. We would need to have adjusted.
Thank you very much, Ms. Van Flyen. Any questions from the committee? Seeing none, I wonder at this time if we actually might afford the opportunity, Ms. Mead from the court system, to perhaps come forward and speak to the court system's experience, dare we say, success with a retirement incentive program.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. Also, for the record, we have no position on HB 11. It doesn't affect the court system at all. But for the committee's information, we did have a retirement incentive program in place at the court system that we consider to have been very effective. Ours differs from what's in the bill, but I'll just tell you what we did. There's different definitions, I suppose, for a retirement incentive program. Ours was not an early retirement program. It was truly just an incentive. So we have non-covered employees in the court system, and we're, of course, much, much, much smaller than the executive branch or anybody else. So being so streamlined, this was a little bit easier for us to do. And I'm not here to suggest this is the way anybody else should do it. But for our program, we identified people who were already eligible to retire, and they had to have been eligible to retire for at least 3 years. So that means they had to have had 30 plus the 33 years of PERS service, or if they were in Tier 1, they had to be 58 years old because you're eligible at 55, or Tiers 2 through 4, they had to be 63 because you're eligible at 60. So they already had to be eligible to retire, and they had to have been working with the court system for 10 years. They could have had some of their state service elsewhere. And these were individuals who, for whatever reason, though being eligible to retire, financial reasons probably, were hesitant to take the plunge. So this was truly an incentive program, a nudge, and what we did was offer incentive pay. If you, who are already eligible, will retire, will commit to us now that you're going to retire, by the end of August of 2016 it was, we will give you 3 months' pay. And it was clean. It had nothing to do with PERS. They didn't get PERS credit for those 3 months. There was no buying in. There was no bonding thereafter. They had to agree to do it during 2016 because we were using FY16 funds. And when they irrevocably promised to do that during 2016, those funds were then dedicated to that, and they had to retire by the end of August 2016. So it was simply a nudge to get people who could do it to actually do it. And the reason was, as you've identified, is the people with that much state service are very often paid far out in the steps and are sometimes very expensive employees. Now, the counter to that is, as Representative Josephson noted, they're often extremely valuable employees because of all the experience they have. But for us, that group amounted to only 28 people. So 28 individuals fell into that group. 14 of those decided to take advantage of the program, and as a result of that, we're saving $680,000 per year, and that's an ongoing savings. We did not have any restrictions on what would happen to those positions. Some indeed became vacant and are still vacant, with the work being absorbed by others. A couple of those, the person came back at reduced hours, maybe 10 or 14 hours a week instead of full-time, and were able to do parts of the job that way. And some, we were able to hire somebody at a Step A, for example, rather than the existing employee who might be way out at the Step MNO or however far you get with your merit and step increases. And that's our program in a nutshell. I'd be happy to answer any questions, but we do consider it to have been one of our successes as the court looked to reduce its operating costs over the last few years. It was a one-time only plan, though.
Thank you. Representative Josephson.
Yeah, through the chair. Ms. Mead, when Chief Justice Stowers has given the State of the Judiciary and talked about a 4% cut or whatever it was, is this is one of the means of achieving that that cut?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, there are two maybe different cuts that you might be thinking about. Our budget has decreased 3.5% over the last few years. Well, 3.5% each year over the last several years. We've submitted a budget that's less than the prior years by 3.5%. So I've said that a few different ways. The 4% that you're thinking about is one of the things we did to achieve that overall cut in our budget was this retirement incentive program. But the other one that people think about is all our employees, except judges, had to take a 4% pay cut, which was stemmed from the fact that we closed courts Friday afternoon. They increased their hours the rest of the week by a half hour, with the net result of our employees losing 2.5 hours worth of work, which is 4% of their pay. So that 4% of employees' pay saved us money, which is a whole different pot of money than the money we saved through the retirement incentive program. Those are two different things we did.
Thank you.
Any questions for Ms. Mead? Seeing none, thank you very much for that testimonial. At this time, I'm going to hold House Bill 11 for further committee review at another time. And seeing that we have no other business or items on the agenda, I want to notice next week's agenda before we adjourn. On Tuesday, House Bill 224, which is Representative Johnston's with the T, Reemployment of Retired Teachers and Administrators Bill, will be up. That was held till Tuesday at her request, so she could be present as well as key invited testimony. We have House Bill 125, second hearing and public testimony and possible committee action. That's the Lao Hmong Veteran Driver's License and ID Card legislation. And then House Bill 190, which is Representative Tallarico's oral comment for regulations and adoption of regulations. And then on Thursday, we have Representative Knopf's, with an N, House Resolution 5 relating to per diem, our favorite subject. So at 3:50, that concludes our business. Thank you, Kelsey and Heather, for your help today, and we are adjourned.